have a lovely interview for you this week. I talked with Dr. Jim Bueller, who is now a professor at the Drexel University School of Public Health, where I'm going to school right now. But in his previous life, he did what seems like everything at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. We basically talk about everything, but the overarching theme is being flexible in your career. So he started off as a medical doctor and then became interested in, basically, like, he read some stuff and became interested in epidemiology. So from there, he has done basically everything under the sun. So he talks to us about how epidemiological investigations work and what that process is like. He was also one of the people working on HIV and AIDS in the 80s, so he has some interesting insights for us there. And then the end of his career at CDC was focused on technology, on public health informatics, and how that affects healthcare, and it's pretty great, so enjoy. Good morning, Dr. Bueller.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good. I am here with Dr. Jim Bueller, who is a professor of health management and policy at the school where I'm getting my MPH, Drexel University School of Public Health. And he's got his tea ready, and he's all ready to talk to us. So how are you?
I'm great.
Good, good. So let's talk a little bit about how you got into public health and what first interest you and how everything got started for you.
Sure. I got interested in public health in two different ways. One was when I was in medical school at the University of California at San Francisco. I found myself being drawn and particularly interested in classes on parasitology. And I think that was the first opportunity I had in my medical training to really understand how health and disease is shaped by environments, particularly with parasitology, where the diseases are now very rare in this country, but more common in other countries where sanitation is not so great, where people are less wealthy than us, where the access to safe food and water is less well assured, that the role of the environment and the culture and your living circumstances and how that affects health, it really came home to me. I mean, clearly that's true no matter where you live, but I first became aware of that in studying parasitology. Then as I was doing my clinical training in pediatrics and subscribing to different medical journals, the New England Journal of Medicine, the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, I became very interested in articles on disease outbreaks and how they were investigated and the interplay between medicine and epidemiology that I was seeing in those articles. I wrote a letter to CDC. I said, I saw this article in the journal. This is very interesting to me. How do you do this? The paper that caught my attention happened to be written by somebody from CDC. And I got a letter back that told me about a program at CDC called the Epidemic Intelligence Service, or mm-hmm. EIS. And I ended up applying to that. The EIS is a two-year program that CDC offers to people who are coming out of clinical training, or you might have a training in other disciplines, a PhD in epidemiology, or as anthropologist. People come into it from a variety of disciplines, but largely health disciplines. And it's a two-year program where you have a short three-week training period in the basics of epidemiology, and then you're assigned either to a state or local health department somewhere in the country, or you're assigned to a division at CDC, and for 2 years get exposed to the practice of epidemiology and the science and practice of disease prevention and control as part of a team and as part of an on-the-job learning. So that was really my introduction to public health.
I ended Where were up you
staying
located?
At CDC for many years. My assignment was to a state health department, but it happened to be the state health department for Atlanta, for the state of Georgia. So I was, although CDC is based in Atlanta, I was across town at the state health department based in Atlanta. And I had a chance to be involved in a number of different investigations, as well as to meet people who'd been working in the front lines of public health for many years in Georgia.
Were there any interesting outbreaks while you were there?
Sure. One of the first outbreaks I investigated was an outbreak of conjunctivitis or eye infections that were being transmitted by among patients who were being seen in an ophthalmologist office.
And
apparently there was a problem with how the instruments that were being used to examine the pressure of the eye were being cleaned. At that time, the device that measures the pressure in the eye actually had to touch the surface of the eye. Nowadays, it's done without touching the eye, but at that time it touches the eye, and if it's not cleaned properly, infections can be transmitted from one patient to another. That was the first disease outbreak I investigated. Also investigated a cluster of hepatitis cases associated with a contaminated well in a rural community where one of the springs that was used as a source of the well happened to be located within the confines of a hog pen. Not terribly sanitary.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
And then I investigated clusters of infant deaths in Georgia. Very rural, poor communities. Infant mortality rates are somewhat higher in the rural areas, and I became interested in efforts that were being done to reduce infant mortality in Georgia. My background had been in pediatrics, and I got involved in studying trends in infant deaths and trying to understand why infant deaths rates varied in one part of the state compared to the other, to see if there were clues that could be gained into how they could be prevented. Much of the advances that had been made in reducing infant deaths occurred either from improving newborn care or obstetric care in the very early periods after birth, but also in improving well child care that can affect infants' health throughout the first year of life. Another investigation that I did was in Toronto, Canada, and EIS officers like myself might be assigned to one health department or a part of CDC, but if there's a need for help in an investigation outside of the area of your normal assignment, you could get called up to that. This was an unusual outbreak in that a nurse had been arrested and charged with murder in the deaths of three or four infants, and she'd been accused of administering overdoses of digoxin, which is a very commonly used drug in cardiology or heart care. The deaths had occurred on a children's cardiology ward at a large referral children's hospital in Toronto. And she was subject to a very long preliminary hearing that lasted nearly a year. And at the end of that hearing, the judge concluded that, as best he could tell, this woman was an outstanding nurse, and in an ideal world, she would have never been arrested. And yet it was clear that there had been an unusual increase in deaths. So this was an unusual outbreak, and the CDC got invited to investigate almost a year after it was over, but there was a lot of uncertainty about what had happened. The Ontario Ministry of Health was involved, and they asked CDC for help, and I was the EIS officer who got tapped to go up to do that investigation. It taught me a lot about epidemiology, about investigating health problems in hospitals, but also about an extraordinary circumstance where there had been concerns that the deaths were the result of intentional acts, and ended up spending time coming back to Canada testifying in further judicial hearings.
Wow. That's, I guess I never really thought about epidemiology as looking at intentional deaths like that. But I guess if you do have a cluster, you're trying to figure out how that happened.
Right. So it's very common for epidemiologists to be involved in investigating disease outbreaks that occur in hospitals. Typically, those are clusters of infectious diseases. There's some problem with cleaning surgical instruments, or there's a problem with a contaminated product, or somehow disease is being transmitted from one patient to another. There's an entire branch at CDC that's focused on improving the safety and health of patients in different healthcare settings. So the approach to the investigation was no different from many investigations that CDC has done over the years to study disease clusters in hospitals. But what was different in this instance was the suspicion that the deaths were the result of intentional acts. What we found was that over a 9-month period, there was roughly a 4-fold increase in the rate of deaths. They were clustered mainly on one shift very late at night, and based on the assessment that was done by an expert cardiologist, the timing of deaths for children that died during this period compared to children that died at other periods didn't quite fit with their clinical course. They all had serious heart disease, but they were, the sudden deterioration in their status occurred at a time that didn't fit with the expected trajectory of their disease.
They were dying earlier or later than they should
they
have?
Were. They, many of them were recovering from complex heart surgery or had other complicated heart disease. And we're at high risk of death, but the timing of their death just didn't fit with what you would expect, given their recovery.
And that was what prompted the initial investigation.
Well, what prompted the very initial investigation was that there were one or two children who had very high levels of digoxin in their blood.
What does digoxin do?
Digoxin's a medication that strengthens the heart muscle. So that in a patient with heart disease, it's very commonly used to increase the vigor of the heart's contraction.
Okay.
And it's a drug that's very effective, but there's a fine line between the best dose and giving too much. It has
right.
to be given very carefully so that the patient doesn't get too high a dose, because it can be helpful at the right dose but very toxic at an elevated dose.
I would imagine that it's hard to dose such a small child.
You have to be very careful.
Right.
In pediatric training, we're taught to very carefully document your calculations.
Right.
Again, nowadays it's much more automated, but still, you have to pay very careful attention to calculating the digoxin dose. But what prompted the initial investigation was that there were concerns that children, a few of the deaths were occurring at a time that wasn't expected, and there were one or two where digoxin measurements had been taken shortly before the child died and had extraordinarily high levels, including levels of digoxin in at least one child who had never been prescribed the drug. The police investigation actually involved exhuming a number of children that had died during the previous 8 or 9 months. But there was a lot of controversy subsequently about the validity of digoxin measurements from exhumed tissues. But the striking findings remain that there was a distinct increase in the rate of deaths during this 9-month period, which ended abruptly when that first arrest was made. That based on an expert cardiologist, the timing of death didn't fit with the child's course of recovery. And the pattern of death was very strikingly consistent with what you would expect if digoxin toxicity were involved. and that this distinguished children, who many of the children who died during that 9-month period, compared to children that died either before or after, we really couldn't come up with any reason to explain why there'd been an increase in deaths. Was there kids sicker at this time? Was something new done? Oftentimes, if there's a change in procedure, you might see a problem that can occur. But we couldn't come up with any explanation. The very last step of our investigation was to study whether there was any association between when particular staff were on duty and when the deaths occurred. With the doctors, they tended to rotate on in 4 or 6 week intervals, so there was no doctor whose presence was aligned with the deaths over that 9-month period. But there was one nurse who had a very striking association with the occurrence of death. As I recall, the rate of death was nearly 60 times higher during the times that she was on duty compared to the times that she wasn't.
Wow.
And no other nurse had anything like that. And that was not the woman who was originally arrested. But there was never a second arrest. There was a year-long inquest, 6 months of that, focused on how the police handled the initial investigation. There was a lot of criticism of how the police handled it, that they had arrested the wrong person, but a second arrest was never made. The team that I was part of spent several days on the witness stand testifying. But the case remains unresolved. There was never a second arrest. There was never anyone brought to trial. The nurse whose duty times corresponded to the increase in deaths was never charged with a crime. She stayed in nursing, although not in pediatric nursing, and died several years ago. So whatever happened remains unknown. I saw a newspaper article from Toronto that was published years ago, revisiting this 20 or so years later. It's still a very sad story. The parents talk about the anguish that they feel their children's death was unexplained, and there was never a good accounting for what happened, or at least no definitive accounting for what happened.
Is that frustrating for you, having been part of the investigation, to find out that it's still inconclusive all these years later?
Well, of course. But it also points to the difference between what an epidemiologist can do and what a criminal investigator does. We can show that there's an association, even an association as high as 60 or so times greater a risk when one person's on duty versus times that others are on duty or that person's not on duty. But that doesn't necessarily establish causality in the eyes of the legal system. There was never any other evidence, like an eyewitness or anything that could directly link an individual to the death. So, like I said, another arrest was never made. And it was also very, very tragic that the nurse who was initially arrested but then completely exonerated. I mean, she spent a year being called a baby murderer on the front pages of the Toronto newspapers.
Did she go back to nursing?
I believe so.
Wow.
Yeah.
That shows some dedication right. to your career.
But I think that's an example of, I mean, this is something that, this is an investigation that I did over 25 years ago, and you can see that it's stuck in my mind as a formative event in my career. But I've gone on to do many other things since that time.
Right, but it is obviously a big part of what has informed what you've done since then, because it's now, you know, it was an important story in your development.
Right.
For how? So then what'd you do after this?
So I completed my 2 years as an epidemic intelligence service officer, and I stayed on at CDC and ended up staying there for over 25 years. And I did different things at CDC. Some people who work there work in a particular area for their entire career, and they develop a tremendous depth of expertise on that particular topic. Others do different things and bring ideas from one part of the agency or one discipline to another. I worked for a number of years in maternal and child health at CDC. I went on to work in a part of CDC that was supporting disease surveillance systems or disease tracking systems, how we track health and disease trends in populations. And then I, in the late 1980s, moved over to work in HIV/AIDS and stayed there for a number of years, and was involved in keeping track of trends in AIDS and HIV in the population here in the United States. But then evolved to being more interested in not just generating the data that are telling us what the trends are, but being part of the management team that takes those data and other information and tries to decide what course will CDC take, how do we use that to manage our programs, how do we use that to inform how we direct our efforts to prevent the disease.
What was it like working on HIV/AIDS? Surveillance. It was you were working on surveillance,
right?
That, in the 80s.
It was a mix of feeling that we were working on something very important, and also an opportunity to be innovative. Because AIDS was a heightened concern, there were resources available to do surveillance well, and even with good resources, no system to track the health of populations is perfect, but it was much better for HIV/AIDS than other diseases. There were the core systems that tracked general trends, but then we had other approaches to digging a little deeper, to characterizing the spectrum of disease, or to understanding trends and behaviors that shape the risk of HIV, or that shape the health of people that have HIV. So it was a chance to be a part of a big effort at CDC for something that was a very important public health problem. It was also happening at a time when our understanding of the disease was changing rapidly. Initially, it was recognized in men who have sex with men, and increasingly then it was recognized in people who'd received blood transfusions, in women, in people who were exposed to HIV through injection drug use. And as HIV appeared in different populations, then the manifestations of the disease change, the way that we were tracking the disease had to change. Initially, HIV was recognized in its most severe form as a condition of AIDS, when people were very, very ill, and over time it changed to a disease that was managed less in hospitals and more in clinics or outpatient settings. As initial treatments came into to be developed and became more effective, then it became almost a chronic disease and almost not quite a chronic disease. It's still a life-threatening disease, but there are people alive today who I know worked with, who represented the HIV community, that who were alive today and 30 years ago, that wouldn't have happened. I think the other thing that happened with HIV is that it was one of the first diseases where CDC was pushed in a way to work with communities around disease surveillance and disease tracking. There's long a sense of engagement with communities of affected people and managing prevention programs, and that was clearly a part of HIV. But because the surveillance data were so important in driving public policy and driving the allocation of funds for prevention and care, the AIDS data were used in funding formulas to determine how much care money under the Ryan White HIV Care Act different states or large cities got. And sometimes the disease tracking criteria were actually used by programs to determine whether people were eligible for different services. It wasn't the intent of the criteria that we used to track the disease that they would be used in that way, but they were. So there was a lot of interest from the community in disease surveillance, which was unusual. And it gave me and all of us who were working in HIV a chance to work not just with what you might call the traditional constituents of doctors and other public health officials, but there was a very active engagement of people who had HIV or people who represented communities affected by HIV. And that was a wonderful opportunity, a tremendous opportunity to be informed by people who were directly affected by what you were doing, but also to benefit from their insights and their perspectives. And sometimes that wasn't easy. Sometimes they were very critical of the approach that CDC was taking. I had experiences of being in public meeting where somebody that I've known pretty well, different meetings and collaborations, is that I'm about to go on to a podium with that person, and she pulls me aside and says, "Jim, I just want you to know what I'm going to say isn't personal."
Uh-oh.
And, you know, they're critical of the agency or the approach that your organization is taking. And she was right. It's not personal, but it's hard not to take it that way.
Do you think that the beginnings of HIV and AIDS in the United States changed the CDC in its mission or in its techniques, or
I think CDC has changed over the years as the problems that public health has had to confront evolve, but clearly AIDS really cast the CDC into the public limelight, perhaps in a way that it had never been seen before. CDC is a federal agency. Unlike most federal agencies, it's not in Washington, D.C. It's in Atlanta. And, well, CDC is often in the news as different outbreaks come up. You know, think of Legionnaire's disease or toxic shock syndrome, things that get a lot of visibility.
The flu.
HIV and AIDS did a number of things. It brought a lot of money to CDC. A lot of resources got put into HIV, so CDC's budget increased. With the budget increase, it increased its visibility. HIV and AIDS was, in some respects, a political disease, and so CDC got a lot more scrutiny than it had before. But also because of AIDS activism, CDC had people demonstrating in front of its offices. That was something new. So it changed public health. It changed not just CDC, but it changed all of public health. People working in state and local health departments where the epidemic was unfolding.
Do you is there anything that really sticks out to you about your work in that period as something that was different from the way that you did things before?
Well, I think it for someone who's an epidemiologist who works with statistics and sits behind a computer terminal and constructs databases, it really, I think, connected you to the problem.
In a
very substantial way, but I think it's the scale. So if you investigate a small cluster of disease, you're visiting a community, you're talking to people that are affected, you're visiting the doctor's offices in that community, you're getting out to look at the drinking well, the well where the drinking water is coming from, or you're going to people's homes to interview them. So that in public health, there's always a connection to the community. But I think what AIDS did is put that in a much larger scale.
And so that was different for you as well as for the CDC.
Yeah, I mean, but it was happening for me as everything
right.
was new for me. So
right.
I was young.
I guess that's
young
true.
In my career. So it was a succession of new experiences. I think that's one of the things that I've enjoyed about working in public health is that I've had a chance to do different things. When the anthrax cases occurred in 2001. It was one of those situations where CDC mobilized people from across the agency, and I put my name in and said I'd be happy to help out. My wife was about 3 months pregnant at the time, and I said, I can help, but
stay
I have
away.
To stay in Atlanta. And I got a call and said, how would you like to go up to New Jersey and head up the team that's been there? We've had somebody up there for several weeks, and she needs to come home running the CDC team up there. It was based in Trenton, worked very closely with the state epidemiologist, Dr. Eddie Bresniff, and the state health officer, Dr. George DeFernando. And so sort of true to CDC lore, I packed up what I could find out about anthrax, went to a few meetings, read that on the airplane, and step off as a here I'm the person heading CDC's anthrax team and here in Trenton. Of course, supported by people that spent their career working in anthrax or
right,
that
right.
That know this very, very well. And again, I think what was interesting about the anthrax situation is it's another example of working with communities. Here was with the postal workers and working with the representatives of the different unions or the representatives of management and in many ways the unions were concerned and skeptical. One of the things that happened with anthrax is that the knowledge kept changing. The understanding of what was going on, what was the strain of anthrax that was happening, how widespread were the exposures, what antibiotic was this particular strain sensitive or resistant to. All of the information about the outbreak or the cluster was evolving very quickly, and so the response was changing, and what had been done initially in another city might be different from what, for example, what medications were recommended now in New Jersey. And it was difficult to explain to people that the change in how we were responding or our understanding of the risk evolved as the investigations unfolded.
So it was
striking how the perspective of working with affected communities in HIV translated to working with the affected groups in the Postal Service.
What do you mean?
Well, at first, the challenge was that convincing people that not everybody needed to take the prophylactic medications. Some people who were worked in the facility where these letters were being processed were recommended to take antibiotic prophylaxis, but people who worked in the postal system outside of that facility didn't need to take it. And And initially there was a lot of concern and fear, understandably. Many more people wanted to take the prophylactic medicine than really needed to take it. After a few weeks, when people realized that this upset their stomach and created diarrhea and had unpleasant side effects for some, then the challenge shifted from convincing some people they didn't need to take it to convincing the people who did need to take it to keep taking it,
right,
and to keep taking it for 60 days. And so I remember sitting with one of the postal representatives, and he said, "Doc, have you ever had a situation where you have to have trouble convincing people to take their medicine and finish their medicine?" You know, I thought, well, we deal with that all the time in diseases like tuberculosis, where you have to take medicine for months on end, and many diseases where people are exposed, they need to take a preventive medicine and complete that. So it's just interesting how a question of what's the strategy to help people complete taking a course of medication, how you've dealt with that with one disease, and now it carries over to being able to deal with that with another, and to understanding what are people's concerns, what is their need for information, what is their need for reassurance, what is the need to monitor those that are taking the medication to make sure that there aren't any more serious side effects happening, and then how do you use that information all together to help people make an informed decision about what they ought to do,
and how to apply the lessons from one disease
right
to another
right
right that's so what'd you what'd
so
you find?
I have a very vivid memory. This was in November of going to a union meeting, and the way that the medicines had been prescribed was that the initial supply was given for about 2 weeks or so, and then they had to be refilled. And so I went to the union meeting to say, we're going to have a refill clinic this weekend. Everybody needs to come, you know, talk about that. I'd planned to be there for about 5 minutes. And it was November. It was cold. But to go to this meeting, we walked up a narrow stairway. The meeting hall was in a room that was very warm and filled with cigarette smoke. I remember the head of the union, big guy wearing a t-shirt, I was there to talk for about 5 minutes until about come and get your refills, and ended up staying for probably 45 minutes to an hour answering a lot of questions. And many of the questions were, how come you did this with the congressional staffers in the Senate office building, but we got a different medication, or why did you say this initially but now you're saying that? And it was because the understanding was changing, but the perception was that one thing was done with the Senate staffers and another thing that was being done with the postal workers. And the reason for that difference was because the understanding of what the strain of anthrax was, understanding of what the best medication was to treat it or to prevent it, was changing. And so the recommendations changed. But the perception was that they were getting, you know, why are we getting something different? Are we, quote, second class?
Really interesting communication issue,
yeah,
that obviously, yeah, hadn't been communicated clearly before.
Yeah,
and so you found yourself in a position where you had to explain all of these policy changes.
Right. They just had the thirst for information. They just wanted to know. And they really valued someone willing to take the time and answer their questions to say, I don't know if you didn't, or to explain something if you could. It was interesting because at the end, the head of the union says, "Well, Doc, thanks. I guess we roughed you up a bit." And I didn't say anything, but I was thinking, "Well, I've been roughed up before." Yeah. But again, it's about being able to be comfortable with an audience that genuinely is curious, but may not necessarily be inclined to trust you, at least when you walk in the door. Hopefully they trust you a little more when you walk out the door.
Yeah, hopefully. So then you moved into more of the informatics. Is that
right.
True? More looking at what to do with all of this data that's been collected.
Right. So much of my career has been about tracking the health of populations. And when I first started at CDC, there was no such thing as a desktop computer. A computer was something that was a gigantic machine that sat in the basement. And everything's changed completely in the last 30 or so years. Because much of the information that CDC uses to track health arises because people seek medical care and information is recorded when they go to the doctors or go to an emergency department or tests are done, that our ability to track the health of populations grows out of information that is collected when people use medical care. And other approaches as well. But that information is increasingly being collected and stored in electronic formats. And also, instead of mailing a report from a doctor's office to the local health department, to the state health department, and then to CDC, or instead of sending it by fax, it can be sent on a diskette, or that gets put in the mail,
or
more and more by the internet, or over a telephone line.
It's so, in the cloud.
Yeah. So the over the course of the last generation, the way that information gets collected and shared and managed has increasingly been automated, and more recently, in the last few years, the federal government has put a lot of money into encouraging doctors and hospitals to use electronic health records. This is a trend that's been happening for a long time, but the federal government's really given it a jolt to make it happen even quicker with a huge investment. And part of the investment is it's conditional. In other words, in order to get the incentive money for using an electronic healthcare record, you have to use it to do certain things. You have to use it to you have to use a number of the tools that let you take better care of your patients. You have to use it to track your quality of care. Certain indicators: are you giving the patients the services that they ought to have? But there's also requirements to share information with public health. Again, this is nothing new. For hundred years or more, doctors are required to report certain diseases or certain conditions to public health. And now, with this investment in electronic health records, they're being encouraged to use their electronic health record to do some of that reporting automatically. So this has created both an opportunity for public health, but also a challenge, because it means that public health has to be able to have the capacity to receive that new information in the new ways that it's coming, that public health has to be involved in developing the standards for how that information is going to be packaged, and then public health has to be able to take advantage of this new opportunity. And with government budgets the way they are, many public health departments are strained. So this opportunity is coming at a time when they're not necessarily positioned to be able to take best advantage of it. But this is part of a long-term trend in how information use is more and more automatic.
So what did you do at CDC?
So my most recent job at CDC for the last several years was I headed a group that was called the Public Health Surveillance and Informatics Program Office. And virtually every part of CDC runs some sort of disease or risk tracking system, but there's several of those systems that, because they're so big, are run from a central group, and that was the group that I headed. So we ran the national system to track these reportable conditions that states by law require doctors and laboratories to report, and the states get together and agree to share some of that information with CDC. So we ran that system. We ran something called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which is a survey that CDC funds states to conduct. It's a telephone survey. And it queries people on different behaviors that affect health, like smoking, and what they're eating, exercise. Did they get a flu shot? And it's a very important way to track the risk factors for the leading causes of premature death. Many people think of CDC as the infectious disease agency, but the leading causes of premature death are now chronic diseases, and many of the risks for those chronic diseases are shaped by our behaviors and the environments that in turn affect our behaviors. So whether we smoke, whether we eat too much, whether we drink too much, whether we wear a seatbelt or not, whether we get enough exercise, all of those things shape our risk for the leading causes of death. And that survey helps states to keep track of trends in many of those behaviors, and then that helps them develop programs to help people make healthy choices. The third system we ran was a very highly automated disease tracking system that monitored visits to emergency departments and on a daily basis kept track of broad disease patterns as either an early warning system for disease outbreaks or as a way to rapidly characterize disease trends if there was a concern that an outbreak might be occurring.
Where do you see surveillance and informatics going in the future?
So I think this trend will inevitably continue. So the other piece of what our office did was that we were the focal point at CDC for helping the rest of CDC answer that question and also for helping state and local health departments answer that question, both for the here and now, but for where it's headed. So I think that inevitably the trend towards automation will continue, but it's very tempting to think that automation is going to solve all your problems. Number one, you have to have the capacity to take advantage of the automation. And number two, just because you get a lot of information doesn't mean that you can make effective use of it. So there's still a role for the human brain.
Right.
And there's still a role for people to have relationships with each other. And for the local health official to know the doctors in his or her community, to know the key people in the hospitals, in their community, to be able to pick up the phone and say, we're seeing something unusual in our disease tracking, what's going on? To have the confidence of the community that the doctors or nurses will give you a call, and because oftentimes they're the first people to notice something before your fancy automated systems can pick it up. People that are actually there seeing patients. So I think ideally there will be a marriage between technology and human capacity that is greater than the sum of the two. Whether that promise is fulfilled remains to be seen. It won't be automatic. It will take investment and a lot of effort.
And a lot of time,
yeah,
I would think,
right,
to adjust, because it will be a big change, mm-hmm, in the way that public health understands its role and,
right,
and the technology that we now have that's, you know, unlike anything that we've had before.
Right.
So it'll be really interesting, and I don't know, I'm interested in how we're going to figure all of this out, and especially if we have different health departments and or different geographic areas with different capacities.
That's always the case.
Right.
That's inevitable. And there's always going to be some health departments that are on the edge and have the people that and the resources to to exploit the technology, and there's going to be others who just say, give me something that works.
You know, right.
I have no idea what happens under the hood of my car every morning, but I can make it start and get my kids to school and get to the train station to come to work. And so the trick will be to make the technology work for the public health people that
right.
that aren't the techno geeks,
right? Which is a lot of us,
right.
I think. So as we wrap up, I have one more question for
sure.
You. Is there anything in particular that you're proud of in your career? Like, is there one thing that sticks out as like the time where you're like, yeah, I really nailed this one?
I think there's different things. I can't say there was a, you know, Henry V at Agincourt. You know, I don't have one of those, but I think I can take pride in my persistence. That not everything we do in public health is glamorous and on the front page of the paper, but hanging in there. And working with people over a sustained period of time leads people to trust you. It gives you a sense of perspectives that allows you to connect the dots that others might not see. It allows you to bring together people with different perspectives. I think if anything, what I'm proud of is the different opportunities I've had and my ability to work with people across disciplines and to make teams like that work, whether it's four or five people or 100 people. But I do take pride in being able to work with others that know a lot more than me about many different things and to make that group effective.
That's something definitely to be proud of. Especially if you're working on something like anthrax or HIV/AIDS, that seems like that's a really crucial piece to have. You don't have to be the expert on everything, but if you can get all those experts together and get them working together, that's an important piece of it.
It's essential.
So thank you so much for talking with me, and have a nice day.
Great, thank you.
So that's Dr. Jim Buehler. He is awesome. Among other things that he talked about, which, right, it was like everything, he talked towards the end about health information technology, or public health informatics. So this week's action item is to think about public health informatics and, you know, see if there's any ways in your personal life that you're using informatics. This may be through your primary care doctor or a specialist that you see. Maybe they use electronic health records. Maybe they have an online patient portal. There's lots of options. Or maybe you use a website or an app or something like that to track your exercise or your food intake or to give you encouragement. Or maybe you're using like a smoking quit app. I don't know what you might be doing, but you know, there's a lot out there, and it's all kind of this new frontier of health that we are all a part of. So I encourage you either to think about how you can advocate for more technological advances in your doctor's office, or alternatively, how you can integrate it into your own life in your own way. You know, that could be either through downloading a mobile app or finding a website that helps you. I suggest one app that I really like is called Calm, calm.com, C-O-M. And it's a bunch of like mindfulness meditations that you listen to. They're guided meditations, and you can listen to them, and you know, they have some for like creativity or confidence or relaxation or sleep is always good. So, you know, take a look at what's out there and see what you can do in your own life. So thanks again for listening to Action Phase Podcast. You can find me on Twitter at Action Phase Pod or at Tegan Keating, TEAGANKEATING. You can find Action Phase's website, actionphasepodcast.com, or you can find me at TeganK.com. Thanks for listening.